You're listening to an M Pavilion podcast. We acknowledge the people of the Eastern Kulin Nation as the traditional custodians of the land on which M Pavilion stands. We pay our respects to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to the traditional custodians of the land where you're tuning in from, around Australia and across the globe.
Hi everyone. Thanks for braving the heat tonight and coming down to M Pavilion for Officeware. And thanks to M Pavilion for hosting us. My name is Rachel Elliott-Jones and I'm the Head of Public Programs for Molonglo. And I've had the pleasure of putting this event together for the PayPal Melbourne Fashion Festival Independent Program. Molonglo is a property development company, but an unconventional one. Our intention is to create inclusive places that positively contribute to cities, improve people's lives and instill pride. Molonglo does this through property investment and development, but also research, publishing and public programs such as this event. Officeware is a conversation about shifting standards in workplace attire, which is part of a broader exploration of work culture that we've initiated in relation to public office, which is a new centre for creative work that we're working on in Collingwood. It will be the first Australian project for London-based 6A architects and landscape architects Dan Pearson Studio. So we're joined tonight by Lucianne Tonti, sustainable fashion journalist and fashion editor of the Saturday paper, fashion designer Erica Vaughan, whose garments are intended to bring joy to all bodies, and Harriet Richards of RMIT Fashion and Textiles, who is the co-founder of the Critical Fashion Studies Research Group. Sadly, Thomas Riley from P. Johnson, Taylor and Clothier has had to send his apologies due to a medical emergency, but the wonderful Jane Matthews is here instead. Jane is the co-owner of Svensk, a Swedish multi-brand clothing store in Melbourne, which emphasises the style of minimalism and functionalism. So I'll now hand over to Lucianne to steer the conversation.
Thanks, Rachel. Thanks to everyone so much for coming out tonight. It's very hot, obviously, so we really appreciate you being here. And I'm really just so amazed by this venue. So thank you to M Pavilion for hosting us here too. So look, I think this is such a great topic of conversation, you know, officeware, like, because we've just come through such a crazy kind of time, obviously, with COVID impacting the way that we all work and what we wear to work. But in addition to that, we've had, you know, the dot-com boom, you know, workplaces becoming gradually more casual, the rise of kind of tech bro chic. And so I think it's interesting to kind of start with officeware and like where we're at in 2024. So Harriet, I think if you could speak to that a little bit, that would be great.
Yeah, sure. And funnily enough, I don't really work in an office very often. So it's like not from personal experience. I work mainly at home. But I think, as you say, you know, we've come through this quite momentous 3 years of changing workplaces. And I mean, yeah, 5 years ago, who knew what Zoom was? Like, completely changed. And so there was so much commentary during that time about changing dress codes in general, you know, party at the top and or business at the top and pajamas at the bottom to go onto your Zoom calls. And I think a lot of that has flowed through to what we're wearing at work now. So there's been a kind of gradual casualization of workwear. But at the same time, and I've spoken about this with other people, there's been kind of this desire to return to dressing up as well. So returning to wearing heels that had maybe been languishing at the back of the closet for those years of COVID. And there were articles that came out about the return to sequins. I mean, Taylor Swift is very good with, you know, getting us back in sequins as well, return to wearing kind of more flamboyant clothes that we hadn't been able to wear during that period. So I think the two things are happening at the same time, this casualization, the kind of rise of active wear and sports leisure, but also a return to kind of more formality and flamboyance in dress.
Yeah, that's interesting. I read somewhere that in times of economic turmoil, we're more inclined to kind of dress up for our employer so that we feel more secure at work, because it's like a signal, like we're here, we're making an effort. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, there's been some really interesting studies done. There's a white coat study about, which is very famous, how people perceive people in the workplace based on how they're dressing, and that's a lot to do with physicians and doctors and wearing a white coat and being taken more seriously. But likewise, other studies, there's a red shoe study which has been done that says that unconventionality can increase your perceptions of your authority, being dressed a little bit more unconventionally. So I think certainly in this time of very uncertain economic times, there is a desire to be more secure in our work, absolutely. And so perhaps that does play into how we're dressing in the workplace as well.
And Jane, what are you seeing at Svensk in your customers, what they're asking for when they're coming in?
Work was such a huge sector of the market. And I really think when I'm interacting with people, they're coming in and there's... It depends where they work. So if they're an architect, they're asking for or working in the design industry. It's a very clear direction that the pendulum has swung to more what's on trend. But then if we're lawyers or accountants or people working in finance that are coming in, their workplace has said to them, dress for your day. And they're coming in almost perplexed about what to wear. So they knew that once upon a time their workwear is, I go to work, I wear a suit. And now, on the weekend, I wear something else. Whereas now they're being told, no, you can dress for your day. And they just don't know how to create that uniform for work. So they will come in and say, I absolutely do not know what to wear to work now that the guidelines have been changed in my office. So, and something that we've spoken about is, I had a little walk around Melbourne today. And depending on what street you're on, it will depend what people are wearing. So I was on Flinders Lane, where it's a much more finance area, and it absolutely was conservative. Whereas now where I am on Little Collins Street and down up where there's a bit more design and architects, you'll see the people on the street wearing something completely different, but they're both wearing workwear, yeah. Office wear. Yeah.
And so, Eric, I read this quote of yours and I want to read it to you. As a business, I'm devoted to centering the creative process around people of all colours, identities, shapes and sizes. I want to redefine the perceptions of femininity and masculinity, which is, I think, a really beautiful sentiment. And I'm really curious how you see that kind of fitting into workwear, because it can be quite traditional in its gender stereotypes.
Yeah, definitely. So when it comes to workwear, I'm quite lucky because I don't necessarily dress to go to work as a designer, so I get to wear whatever I want. And yeah, very lucky to be able to sort of share my idea of what workwear might look like and, you know, sort of help others find a way to express themselves. So I find that, you know, if you are able to express your identity through what you wear, because looking at if you are going to work 30 to 40 hours a week, I feel like it's important for you to be able to express yourself through your clothing. So yeah, definitely think it's quite important. Yeah.
But I find, to your point, you're saying that people their clothing expresses their identity. I find sometimes clothing expresses people's creativity. So if you are an architect or working in design, sometimes your clothing is really an extension of your work. So they don't see their clothes as workwear because they'll wear their clothes Monday to Friday, but they're the same clothes that they wear on the weekend because the industry in which they work in allows them to be more expressive. And so that's why I do tend to work a lot more with people in the design sector. And I think it's how do you find that when you're working in a more traditional environment, that do you express yourself through jewellery or through lipstick or through hair? Or I find it when I look at the more traditional workplaces, I do wonder how do they express themselves through their clothes.
Well, it kind of... Do you want to...
I'm just trying to think of, like, you know, if I had to go to a 9-to-5, I would definitely think I would struggle a lot. And if I was to do a suiting to go to work 9-to-5, it'd be with some sort of polka dots or some sort of brooch or something to, you know, to express myself. But I definitely think maybe it would be quite hard to, yeah, sort of find myself within the normal traditional kind of workwear. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, those tensions, because, you know, what we're talking about is kind of office jobs, and they come with these kind of conservative tropes around them. There was an interesting incident in 2019 where Goldman Sachs decided to relax their dress code standards, and they sent out this very strange email, and I'm going to read some of it now. So, due to the changing nature of workplaces generally in favour of a more casual environment, we urge employees to dress in a manner that is consistent with your clients' expectations. And what I think is so interesting about it, it's like it's kind of trying to relax these kind of norms that might have been seen as quite elitist, but in a way it's still kind of perpetuating that elitism, because it's like, if you know, if you're the kind of banker that knows what his client wants you to dress like, then you'll be fine. And if you don't know, then maybe, you know, maybe you're not a very good banker. Maybe this isn't, you know, where you should be. And so maybe, Eric, I'll stay with you. Like, how would you, what would you do if that was, you know, if you were in a kind of workplace and they were like, well, figure it out?
Wow. I would probably have to rethink about the workspace, to be honest with you. Maybe it's not the right fit for me to begin with. So, and yeah, just having to, if I had to dress to please someone, it would be quite hard. So I think for me, I would...
But yeah. You don't do that at all? Like, because, like, you know, I don't work in an office either, but when I'm going to meet someone, I'm still taking into account how I, you know...
How
they might
so
want
you're
me
sort
want
of
to
putting yourself. Yeah, I agree. So to a certain level, yes, you are dressing for someone else. But I think if you are dressing for yourself to begin with, it will shine through. So yeah, I think you have to dress yourself first rather than thinking of what the other person might be thinking of you. So as long as you're happy, you know, so the whole point of Eric Yvonne is to, I'm trying to bring joy to everyone's sort of wardrobe. So for me, it's important for someone to feel happy in what they're wearing. So if you're happy, it will shine through. Yeah.
And what do you think?
Well, I do get that question every week. So every week I have a man walking in totally dazed and confused, and he's come to a new workplace. My shop is 80% men, so a lot of my references will be to my male customer, but of course some of those lines will cross over to the other side of the room. I always say you've got to dress comfortable. If you're not comfortable and you're dressing in something that's not reflective of your style and your personality, you're not going to be the best version of you, and you're not going to deliver your best work at work. But I generally just start with pants. We generally just get that base sorted, get some nice little those standard building blocks in your wardrobe, and then you can play with the top. So dressing for your day, if it's a really nice heavy cotton t-shirt, that's the more casual days. And then if you've got a meeting, you're not necessarily dressing for that person's expectation, but you're showing them, I'm dressing up for you because I respect you and I respect this meeting. If you turn up with your shirt ripped or shoes worn and torn, it does communicate to the person, I haven't necessarily thought about meeting you. So it's not dressing to show I put in some effort to make that meeting with you. But in my shop, it is very minimal, it's very clean, it's Scandinavian. The girl that my current staff member has a very, very heavy country western look at the moment. She has a wonderful business making big leather belts with big leather buckles. And she wears that in my shop, and that's completely acceptable. I always say to her, if you're not authentic to your style, my style at Svensk is very clean and minimal, and she wore that, she is being unauthentic and it's an imposter. So, yes, she wears a shirt from me, but she'll put it in her style. And we say whoever's on the shop floor picks the music. So we don't always play Swedish music. It's she plays country western music because that's authentic to her, and it creates an environment where she performs at her best. Now, that's fine. I'm a clothing store. It's not the same as working in an office. But I think the theory and the mindset can apply to an office in a more traditional space. That if, yes, you've got to be presentable at work, but you've got to be true to your identity and style. And I haven't seen it fail yet, but I'm sure it does.
This is so kind of heartwarming, like this idea that we can all dress for ourselves, be true to ourselves, you know, self-expression. But I guess historically, you know, we've seen that the suit has really kind of dominated, you know, it's been the uniform of the office for better or worse, for a really long time. And that's slowly starting to change now. You know, we're seeing suits become, you know, they're super trendy at the moment. As much as I hate that tailoring is a trend, they are, and we're seeing them kind of, you know, change. And so I wonder if, Harriet, you could kind of speak to the history of the suit and what it means right now in this cultural moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think as you've both been talking, like, this is a kind of discussion of privilege as well, that we can wear whatever we want to work. Whereas I often think, you know, when I'm on an aeroplane, all the people working on the aeroplane are in uniforms. And there's so many jobs where people have to wear uniforms that, yeah, you think, how are they showing any sort of individuality? Often, you know, stewards have like some fancy nails, or they've done their hair in a certain way, or their makeup. Those are the elements of the accessorizing. And so I think it's interesting when you think about the suit, because it is a traditionally male garment, and that's the history that it has as well, as a kind of point of power and dominance, but also because in those jobs where a suit was required, women didn't have those jobs. And so it was like, well, that was just what men wore, and so women didn't wear those garments because they weren't in those roles. And then so as that changed, then, you know, women were expected to wear a skirt suit, for instance. And so I think the rise of the trouser suit is particularly interesting in the last few years. And as you say, the trend of tailoring, like, tailoring is something quite classic. It's not really trendy, but it's certainly trendy. And it would have been really interesting to hear from Pete Johnson. And I've had lots of conversations, including on the podcast, with Emily from E. Nolan about the work that she's doing with tailoring, which is so fantastic and interesting, especially her work with politicians as well. And I'm like really fascinated, and maybe it's my background in political science, but with what politicians wear and the influence that has, and also the kind of symbolism of suiting for politicians. And she has a lot of clients who are women or non-binary and who work in politics. So the role of the suit in that context says something quite specific, because it is this representation of power, of a position of authority. And so then I think, you know, the taking on of suiting in everyday wear, and I mean, if we think about the slippage between what we wear at work and what we wear on the weekend, I have a gorgeous suit that doesn't fit me at the moment, but that I love to wear on the weekend as well as to work events. And so then you think, okay, well, what is that telling people if I'm wearing a suit on the weekend to, like, go to lunch or something? Does that mean that I'm
dressing up for them?
Yeah, that I'm dressing up for them, and that I've put in some effort, I guess. But I'm not necessarily trying to assert my power and my authority in that setting. So it's often quite context-specific as well.
Yeah.
Well, and what are you seeing at Svensk?
In women's suiting?
Well, in both suiting, because I know that we talked earlier about the idea of, like, a set versus a suit. You know?
Yeah, so I'm not a designer, and I'm not, like, the brands you just referenced. I buy from other existing brands, so we're a multi-brand store, so I don't necessarily control the design, the line, the aesthetic. I'm set by what my brands produce, so they're looking to what's on trend, and I need to pick from that. What we're finding in men's suiting, once upon a time it was incredibly traditional, incredibly like a very clean Italian line. And what all of our, my brands almost completely stopped making suits, whereas my Australian clients kept wanting suits. But my Swedish brands are always, they used to be about 10 years ahead. I find now with fashion, they're always about 5 years ahead. I'll bring something in and people, the elasticized waistband for men's pants, and people are like, I'm never wearing that. And then now that's all I sell. But I've been having them in my store for 5 years. So with suiting, my brands stopped making suits altogether and they moved to something which we call a set. And so it's a jacket, which is like a duster jacket or a worker Japanese jacket, and then they'll have a pair of pants with about five different styles. So if you're into the relaxed fit, you want the tailored fit, you want the tapered ankle fit. And so the idea is you wear the pants 30% of the time, you wear the jacket 30% of the time, and the rest of the time you wear them together. So they want a piece of a garment to be worn all the time, and just not for those special occasions or to work. They want them to be multifunctional, but when you need to wear, you need to just step it up that little bit more for a meeting, you've got something that looks really nice and coordinated, and it can be for work or an event. That's how they see those sets. we've been selling those for about 5 years, or I should say I've been stocking them, and only now am I really seeing that the market is meeting the products that I have. Women, I haven't seen the same thing happening on the other side of the room. Women's suiting, I'm finding, is following that little bit more of a trend of the oversized jacket and the pleated wider pant, and that just doesn't suit everybody's shape. Whereas the men's side, I feel I just have so many more options to meet any type of occasional body shape. On women's, I find it a little limiting, so I don't have a great amount of traction or the numbers to give you sort of feedback or statistic on that. But even I struggle. Tonight I thought I'd put a suit on and none of the pants fit me. It's too hot, but women's suiting is incredibly hard. You've got so many different metrics, the waist, the hips, the thighs, and to get that right, you have to do alterations. And what I find is that men only have to be about 80% happy, and we can tailor everything. The length, that we can retaper the pants, we can take the waist in. Women have to be 100, and I'm exaggerating to make a point, so please excuse me, but women have to be 120% happy to then maybe do the smallest change. So it is, and maybe that's because I've had bad experiences with tailoring before. There's lots of reasons. I theorise about it constantly. I don't want to take up all your time tonight on that, but women's suiting is incredibly hard, but the people I do sell suits to are politicians, because there's not much option in Canberra, I can tell you.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, this idea of the suit as this kind of thing that can like flatter and disguise and, you know, kind of morph things. And I wonder, Eric, if that's something that you see, you know, given that it is now this kind of trendy, excuse us, tailoring a trend, but option that your customer base is coming to you and being like, well, I do want a suit, you know?
Yeah. So we do offer, so I do sort of dabble into suiting. So not a traditional tailoring kind of vibe. So it's just my take on suiting, which is a more relaxed, more fun, sort of two set piece, and one of them, which was quite successful, was a suiting, two piece suiting that I collaborated with Lily, who draws inspiration from her Balinese culture. So we sort of collaborated on a textile print with like lots of big flowers, and it was quite cool. But yeah, do love a good suiting, just with like maybe a plain kind of white singlet and just some sneakers just to tone it down a bit. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. That sounds like something I want to wear too. I think it's interesting that you mentioned Balinese culture there, because you touched a little bit, Harriet, on the policing of kind of, you know, women being told they have to wear a skirt and other things. And I think that kind of crosses over into, you know, or has in some instances crossed over into cultural policing as well in the workplace. That, you know, there's the example of headscarves being banned in France, and in Kenya recently a traditional suit was banned from parliament. And I wonder, you know, I know you're Mauritian, and obviously that, you know, the love of colour and everything is very expressive. And I wonder if you have any thoughts.
So growing up in Mauritius was quite, so I feel quite lucky, because growing up, the TV presenter on TV would have like, you know, she was black, she was African, and she would have braids down to the shoulders. Even my teacher growing up at primary school would wear this beautiful sari and had a bindi. So I was exposed quite, you know, since I was very young to all these different cultures. And for me, I'm like, oh yeah, it just sort of makes sense how we can just all be together and be happy with, you know, with what everyone else has to offer when it comes to their different sort of culture. And I think it's just a matter of time. So the more we're sort of exposed to it, I think we'll embrace it more. Looking back at France, so yeah, it's quite on the other sort of end where you're not allowed, so women, young women aren't allowed to wear the hijab in any sort of government places or even at school. But yeah, I think it's just a matter of embracing it and being exposed to different sort of cultures. Yeah.
Yeah, and it seems something that should be so instinctual in, you know, as multiculturalism becomes, you know, more and more present all over the world, and particularly somewhere like Australia. You know, it feels like very funny to kind of think about these rules that we exist under and then see them drawn with really hard lines. And I think, you know, we've seen that you know, probably, you know, in women's bodies and queer bodies as well in the workplace more prominently than in other areas. You know, Australia doesn't technically have protections for workplace attire, but employers do have the right to expect you to dress in kind of an appropriate way, I think is a paraphrasing the law here very poorly. And so, Harriet, I wonder if you could speak a little bit to, you know, there was an example in 2016 of a woman in the UK being sent home because she refused to wear heels in the office. And I think it's very interesting as, you know, we see the rise of Me Too and women kind of becoming more powerful that, like, now it's like, no, I'm wearing sneakers with my suit. I'm wearing ballet flats with my suit. You know, don't you tell me what I'm going to wear.
That's a crazy example. I think, yeah, there's absolutely still policing, even if it's not like official. It's very unofficial, it's very ambiguous. The expectation really is still there. And I think that certainly comes into these kind of contexts like politics as well. And in terms of gender, maybe I'll speak to some of my experience working with entrepreneurs. And that kind of comes back to the point of making an effort to show that you care in certain scenarios. So I did a huge amount of ethnography with entrepreneurs a number of years ago, pre-pandemic, and worked with women who told me that they would be told off for wearing certain things if they were doing a pitch event. So they were being mentored in an accelerator program or an incubator, and the expectations for the women who were startup entrepreneurs was very, very different from the young men who could come along and wear like a branded polo shirt, which tended to be the uniform that they would wear. And I think it was very much like you mentioned this right at the beginning, at the introduction of this conversation, about that kind of tech bro, Silicon Valley idea that people like Mark Zuckerberg or various other entrepreneurs who we maybe don't want to mention can go onto stage and wear like some Adidas slides, a scruffy old t-shirt and jeans. And women, I just don't know whether they would get away with that. And that was certainly the story that I heard from the participants in the research that I did. There was, you know, it was a hot day like this, and there was one participant who told me that she was wearing like a sleeveless vest, and that was categorically told to her that that was not appropriate for this scenario, which was just wild to me, really, really crazy. And she was like, the guys just wouldn't have been told that. I don't know whether they would have turned up in a singlet, so with their arms exposed, but I also, yeah, don't know that there was such high expectations for what they were wearing. When we attended pitch events, the women were predominantly wearing heels and the guys were predominantly wearing sneakers. So just, it was really, I mean, this is not that long ago, but in that context of the entrepreneurial space, it was very, very clear what the expectations were, even though it wasn't like written in a contract when they entered the activator space or the incubator as to what those, you know, gendered norms were going to be. And I think too of the example of Elizabeth Holmes from Theranos, and she really fashioned herself as this you know, respectable Steve Jobs lookalike, exactly, in her black turtlenecks. She even changed her voice. Like, it's so wild the way that she fashioned herself in a particular way to be taken seriously, even though she remained a fraud. So, yeah, I think it's super interesting.
Yeah, and I, you know, it's always kind of like there's always two sides to the debate, right? Because on the one hand, it's like high heels can be very uncomfortable to wear. But on the other hand, sometimes you're like, well, I want to wear heels. I look fabulous in them. And I'm going to, you know, I'm going out. I want to be glamorous. Or I want to embrace, you know, this aspect of my power. And that's how I'm going to show up for, you know, the meeting or the pitch or whatever it is. And I wondered, actually, Eric, in the context of this kind of joyful, fun expression, if you have an opinion on us being like, no one should tell us to wear heels.
Can you repeat that? Sorry.
Sorry, it was a poorly phrased question. So I'm just curious because I can imagine, you know, there's just, you know, everything you're doing, there's so much expression. And part of that expression is, you know, playing with gender norms and all of, you know, the kind of spectrum of what it can be, what dressing can be, and the play of it and the fun of it. And, you know, it's funny, I think, in the context of kind of like white feminism to be like, oh, don't you dare tell me to wear heels when, you know, I have queer friends who would like love wearing heels, and it's a huge part of how they feel that they are empowered.
Okay.
Well, I can help you on that one. I'm not going to touch it in the same way, but, you know, you and I had an experience similar to this. So Lucienne, the history between us is that she early in her career worked at my store, and she had worked at a clothing store where it was expected that she was to have makeup in a certain way, wear a certain type of shoe and wear a certain type of dress. And she turned up the first day to our store with a concrete floor, in high heels, and I don't know if you wore makeup or what you wore, but you were
probably
definitely wearing heels.
I don't
heels.
Remember this, by the way.
Yeah. And
but I don't question that it happened.
And on the very first day, we said, you don't have to do that. Like, if you want to wear sneakers, you wear sneakers. If you want to wear Clark shoes, you wear Clark shoes. If you want to wear Docs, you wear Docs. You want to wear Birkenstocks, wear Birkenstocks. You have to be comfortable, but you ultimately have to be safe. And in a floor like ours, it is absolutely not safe to wear high heels all the time. So we almost went the other way, and we didn't want to, didn't necessarily took away your femininity, but we were saying if there are no expectations on that you need to wear that in a fashion store. And that was a little bit jarring for you. You'd had years of experience of being told to dress a certain way. And
yeah, and some of the time that was really fun.
But I never thought about it that we were taking away your femininity. Now that I hear the story going in one way, I realise perhaps we were at the other end of the pendulum taking that away from you. And maybe at the time it was 15 years ago, so things were different, but there was no Me Too movement back then. But yeah, maybe it's about dressing for the environment as well that's safe.
Well, I think, and that's kind of where the Australian law gets to, right, which I think is this kind of and it's another interesting tension because, you know, you don't want to be policing, you know, we're talking about policing people's bodies and how they express themselves, but at the same time, you know, a workplace does have expectations, you know, and you need people to look a certain way to be representing your business. And so it's like, when does it become too prescriptive? When does it become illegal? When is it just, you know, not fair? But it's a balance.
Yeah.
You don't want to say no. Everyone wants to move on from this one.
I do think some of those lines are very, very blurred, or they're not very distinct. And that sometimes it is about safety. We've got labs on campus, or, you know, studios where you can't wear open-toed shoes because there's like equipment in those spaces. So you have to think about coming onto campus and like, what have I got today? Am I going to be in a studio? Am I going to be able to wear sandals, or do I need to wear covered shoes? So, you know, that's just a safety expectation, so like slipping on a slippery floor in a store. Yeah.
But I was thinking about shoes in the city today, and I think, so I, other than having Svensk, I also go into a lot of offices. I work in operational services and bookkeeping. It's a sort of a side hustle post lockdown and COVID. And so I get the opportunity to go into lots of different industries and see different things. And if you're in the city, or if you're in Fitzroy, or if you're in Collingwood, how you dress does also change to the location in which the office is set. And so in the city, you don't generally see people walking in Birkenstocks and open-toe shoes. It is sort of an enclosed shoe environment. But if you're out in Fitzroy and you only live down the road from your office, you can rock up in your Crocs or a different type of shoe. That wouldn't be acceptable necessarily in the city. Yeah. Just an observation, not a fact.
Yeah, I think there's something else in this that I find really interesting. You know, when we talk about the tech bros who can get up on stage wearing jeans and a T-shirt and a hoodie, and there's like a demographic of the workforce that I really feel for, and we talked about them a little bit, you know, the female politicians who are getting suits made and things like that. And I wonder, you know, for that demographic of women, if you're a, you know, senior executive in a company and the expectation is all of a sudden you're going to show up to work in a hoodie every day, like, that's kind of disastrous for, you know, you're like, for getting dressed and solving these dilemmas. And I wonder, you know, if we're talking about the casualization of the workforce at allowing self-expression and that being a good thing, are we overlooking some of the other challenges that come with it, particularly for that kind of woman?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think about these intersections between the tech bro and the politician and where they kind of overlap. And the other quote that Elizabeth Holmes almost always brought out was Barack Obama, who was like, I don't want to have to think about what I'm wearing every day. I've got too much to think about. So I've just got this wardrobe of suits, these navy blue suits. And then the controversy when he wore a beige suit and how terrible that was. But she often like referenced that. She's like, I'm too busy. I'm too important. I don't have time to be thinking about it. I just need all these Issey Miyake black turtlenecks, and that'll just be what I wear every day. So it's like a self-imposed uniform. And I think maybe for some of these women in these, you know, corporate positions, which I'm not very familiar with, so I'm kind of just speculating here. But I imagine that with a busy lifestyle, maybe there's an element of that, and maybe you see that in some of your clients, creating a sort of uniform of that's sort of self-prescribed, that makes you feel comfortable but also makes you feel confident, that you also feel is appropriate to the setting and what is expected of you. So there's like a few things going on. But I think then at the end of the day, you still have the choice on what you're going to wear, whether it's the hoodie or a suit, if you're in that, yeah, environment.
Yeah, I absolutely do get the question of... I don't want to think about it. Can you just tell me what to do? It happens on both sides of the room, but they'll say, I'm too busy. I've come into a certain level of management. I have to look a certain way. Just please tell me what to do. I don't want to have to think about it. But that doesn't come just to anyone walking off the street. It's people that I've worked with for many years. They trust me. I've got some customers I haven't physically seen for almost 10 years. I just get an email and they're in Collingwood. It's not that far from the city. And they say, Jane, I need an update. And they just know that's sometimes their work wardrobe, but they definitely have something that goes through their life, so to an event or to the weekend. But, yeah, it's definitely someone at a higher management that could possibly afford for that decision to be outsourced, yeah. And I love those clients. I have a lot of fun. But it is a lot of trust.
Yeah. And, Eric, what do you think? So if the casualisation of the workforce, do you think it's fundamentally a good thing?
I'm all for it, as long as it's sort of appropriate. Obviously, I wouldn't expect someone to be, you know, going to the office wearing a bikini. So as long as, yeah,
it wouldn't be very comfortable.
Yeah, definitely it has to be appropriate. It has to work for the workplace. And, you know, if you're more comfortable going to work wearing a tracksuit or a hoodie, sure. But maybe then the focus would be more around the grooming. So, you know, just make sure everything looks nice together and you're sort of well put together. It doesn't quite matter what, you know, sort of pieces of clothing you're wearing, as long as you're sort of the grooming's there. Yeah.
We generally always say one piece in the outfit has to be quite dressy. So yes, the pendulum has absolutely swung to be more casual, but we'll say, fine, wear the faded blue jeans, but wear a blazer with it, or have your tailored pants, but put a heavy cotton t-shirt with it. And that's where we're finding that balance of your whole outfit can't be casual. Like, you can't have a hoodie and tracksuit pants, but if you had a hoodie, put it with some really nice dark blue jeans, because it balances out. And I think that's the office wear for where we're going. That's where it's going. So that's the nice meeting point.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, to have the grooming and also like the touchstones that are like show that there's some effort that's gone in, that, you know, you are part of conventional rules about how we dress, even if it has, you know, slightly shifted. I just check how we're going for time, because I want to... Okay. We might open up to some questions from the audience. There's roving mics, so if you've got a question, just pop your hand in the air.
Hi, how are you going? This is really, it's really actually eye-opening. I didn't really think about, I'm going to start thinking about this when I wake up in the morning. But what I did want to ask you guys was, when you do wake up in the morning, do you... What do you have certainty over? What you're going to eat or what you're going to wear?
Mine is, how am I getting to work that day? There's a constant negotiation at the moment. And ultimately, I live in Brunswick East. I walk to work some days, and so then I'm wearing a certain garment and then changing at work. But the first thing that goes through my mind is how am I going to wrangle my kids to get them fed and to school? It's the food. Yep.
Well, at the moment, I'm a little bit restricted in my wardrobe, so I'm pretty much wearing the same thing all the time. So that's the easy thing. And also, I think how you get to work. I mean, I do work at home quite a lot, but if I'm not working at home, I'm on a bicycle, so I have to think about what's appropriate or, you know, feasible on a bicycle. So I think before I rode a bike a lot, my clothing choices were a bit different, but since I've been, well, in quite a long time that I've been riding, that really dictates what I wear in the morning and what's kind of stayed the test of time in the wardrobe as well. And then what I'm going to eat, that's never quite certain either. Yeah, it depends what's in the fridge.
So for me, it would be some sort of food. So coffee. I need the coffee first, and then I will try and figure out, all right, what am I going to wear today, depending on where I'm going, the weather, what's the weather doing. So coffee first, and then I'll be able to piece it together. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm the same. Coffee first. That's the only certainty when I wake up. Anyone else?
I'm curious, you guys touched on it in a bunch of contexts, but how you see hierarchy playing into this. So you're talking about the casualization of the workforce, meaning that things feel, I guess, more democratic, but then at the same time some roles can, they've got so much wealth or power that they can kind of toy with that idea, or how you see the role of clothes changing either to continue to express hierarchy or to remove that.
That's a really great question. I definitely think there's an element with casualization. We've touched on privilege. Harriet, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of these questions, it's almost like the casualization is more acceptable once you get up the hierarchy. Whereas if you're trying to really, you know, show that you care or and ensure that your job is going to be secure, then it's like there's more expectation that you dress a certain way in order to maintain that security. Whereas once you get further up the ladder, maybe you have more opportunity, more privilege, as you say, to be more flexible with what you wear and be more kind of, yeah, casual in what you're wearing to work. But that's, again, just an assumption, speculation. I haven't looked into it deeply.
My experience is sort of two-pronged. If you're working in an organisation that has a lot of levels of management, the conversations I have is someone comes to me and says, I'm in a new management position, I've got to dress the part. So they are maybe more middle management and they've said, I've come up through the ranks. I'm finding that middle management to upper management are trying to dress the part and be a bit more dressy. They've got to separate themselves from the people that they're managing by dressing that little bit nicer. The flip side of it is when I see an entrepreneur in a smaller, no, they're not necessarily smaller business, but they're entrepreneurs, they want to think that they want to be outside the box and they want it like the Steve Jobs where to disrupt and wear something that's not expected of them. I do find that they will dress more casually and then they're setting the tone for everyone underneath them. So I think it really is industry dependent and also the size of the business dependent on that. But I do always find it interesting that as people move up the corporate ladder, they feel they've got to dress for that position by dressing up, not dressing down, until they own the business. Then they do what they want.
I think it's so interesting too, because that hierarchy kind of dictates the terms as well, you know, which we did touch on too. There was another question over there.
I was just wondering, I feel like there's a more growing consensus or conversations around how much you give to your work, or like setting a balance, work-life balance, and retaining your work, your life outside of work. Generally, like a growing disillusionment with the 9-to-5 or giving capitalism, I suppose. Do you think that, is there any correlation with more casualisation, I suppose?
I think so, yeah. What do you think, Eric?
So, just trying to wrap my head around it. So, I definitely think we are getting a lot more casual when it comes to work, for sure.
Do you think this idea of self-expression, and, you know, you said it before, if someone was like, I want, you know, if I had to toe the line, I'd be like, that's not, this isn't the job for me. And so if we're becoming more confident, you know, does that mean that we are keeping more of ourselves rather than just stepping into a role that, you know, we're getting paid a salary to do all the time? Harriet nodded.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking that, you know, with the new right to disconnect or whatever it's called, the new law that's coming in, whether those boundaries are becoming more rigid, whereas for a long time they, and especially during the pandemic, they became so blurred. It was like, you know, work happened on the screen, but so did socialising, so did everything else. And so now that we're kind of out of that, it's like, oh, actually, work isn't my entire life, so I'm going to put those boundaries back in place. And maybe dress is going to come into that. So there's something kind of nice about thinking, oh, this is my work uniform and I don't wear it on the weekend because that just associates me with the office or with my work environment. And so I'm going to choose to have, you know, two separate sides of the wardrobe that I wear at different times and really, yeah, give work less of myself. So maybe doing less of the representation of my true self in the workplace because that's just where I make my money. Or, yeah, I'm not sure. And I do think it's, again, context-specific and maybe industry-specific as well. I think in the creative industries, those lines tend to stay more blurred than they do in perhaps a corporate environment. So, yeah, that's thoughts. I don't know if you wanted to add to that. Yeah,
I find it hard to speak to it personally because I have my own business. There's a completely seamless line between my private and work. And then again, when I'm working in people's offices, they are small businesses. So I feel that people are, I'm working for small businesses where the owner is sitting there. But I can reflect on a friend of mine who works in a semi-government position. And she works 3 days in the office, which is in the city. And I know that the days that she comes to work, she absolutely flexes and leans into her fashion forwardness. So she does express herself more at work. And yes, the workplace is getting more casual, but she takes the opportunity to dress up. I find it, yeah, it would be hard for me to make an assumption, but I do see a few of my friends putting they're not going more casual to work. They're really putting in the effort because that's when they can play and have fun.
And maybe that's because they only work 3 days a week, so they have more energy to then.
And they definitely weren't doing that when they're in the city 5 days a week.
5 days a week, yeah, that's super interesting too.
I've got a question. I wanted to, maybe going on a bit of a tangent, but ask you about kids' office wear, which is the school uniform. And you've been talking a lot about how in certain work environments things have been getting more casual. But certainly the school uniform seems, in many cases, as traditional as ever, and in a way that always mimicked the kind of workwear of the adults. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on if that's changing or what is it all about? What's going on there?
What do you mean uniforms?
School uniforms, yeah.
Yeah. My kids go to Fitzroy North Primary School, so they don't wear a uniform, and I was completely thrown. When I came to orientation day, some grade sixes walked us around and I was like, oh, is it free clothes day today? And they looked at me like I was an alien. They didn't know, because they'd never known anything different. So I only had my experience of standard of that it had to be a certain way. And I've got two boys and they love soccer. Every single day they wear a soccer uniform. And I say to them, yes, they're expressing themselves. It's pink, red, blue. They're wearing a different soccer uniform every day, but it's their way of their identity, and that's their identity at school. So that just happens to be right now it's soccer. Maybe later in their life it's going to be something else. And I do sit on the tram and I see kids going to schools in uniforms and I think, oh, it feels so cruel that they're so confined and they've got no expression. But 5 years ago I thought, my experiences, my position is changing based on my experience, and I do struggle with the idea of when they go to high school that they're going to be conformed to put into a uniform, whereas I thought it was crazy. I thought it was going to be every problem I had in the morning was how am I going to get these kids dressed in the morning. They dress themselves. It doesn't need ironing. We don't have any fights. It's always something clean to wear. So I'm from Queensland originally, and that doesn't exist in Queensland. Everybody wears a school uniform. And my friends think that I'm the biggest hippie and the craziest person ever, and they think, oh, it's so much trouble. But people only know what they know. And so we are lucky to be living in the north of Melbourne, and we have this expression. I think there's about 5 or 6 schools that are all neighbouring to us that have the same position. And so I know we're in a bubble. So I feel it's very hard for me to make comment outside my little bubble, but I love it. I think it's great. I've got 2 boys that, like I said, some days they're wearing head-to-toe neon pink, the next day they're wearing black, and they feel their whole selves. And it's really fun to let them... I give them a budget at the start of the year and I say, right, let's go shopping. And they pick and choose what they want, and it's a really great experience now, because I hope that they're going to carry that through as they get older and won't be conformed in, I have to wear this and I have to wear that. And, fingers crossed, I'll come back to you in a couple of years if I failed or not.
There's another question over here.
Firstly, I'd like to say I'm pretty jealous that, like, you guys didn't have uniform, but I've also kind of felt like that uniform, you tend to blend in, like you tend to make something of it. The question I had kind of bounced back to the previous question, where you talk about how like there's separation of boundaries and that. How would that push like a formality further up north where it's a more casual environment? But alternatively, would the casualization that's pretty popular up north push down south, and how would the tensions sort itself out over the next decade, 2 decades as we further get more casualized?
What do you mean by north and south?
I mean like CBD versus the inner north.
The inner
because
north.
You guys mentioned that context a lot.
It's true.
I mean, I originally thought you meant up north as in like Queensland. Because you'd mentioned
Queensland. I was like, I'm not bringing shorts and thongs down here.
Yeah, but also because, a lot of it comes down to the climate as well. So what we wear is, so often dictated by what the climate is, and people often say that people wear more colour in Sydney than they do in Melbourne, and I think that has a lot to do with the climate, and then when it's sunny in Melbourne you see more colour, but in terms of the casualisation between suburbs, and I actually had some students last year, I always have students who are super fascinated by the different dress codes in different suburbs in Melbourne, and they're like, if they live in the south and then they come up to Brunswick for uni, they're like, what I wear on campus for uni is so different from what I would wear down in Prahran or like on Chapel Street in the weekend. so they always kind of create these research projects to try and figure out why that is. And also I had one student who was looking at whether people who live in one place but work in another place, how that changes what they're wearing and if they get changed once they get to work, because they didn't feel comfortable on the tram when they're leaving a certain location to go to another location. And I think, in my conversations with her, it's a lot to do with, the demographic who lives in that area and, again, what those expectations are. So... and wanting to blend in or fit in, I mean, these are students who are third year undergraduate students, so they're mainly around 20, 21. So wanting to fit in a lot of the time, but also wanting to have a certain degree of individuality. So that's really coming into their decisions on what they're wearing in different suburban contexts or geographical locations around the city. So, I'm not sure if that quite answered your question, but...
Before I lived in Melbourne, I was in Sweden working for an architects firm and an engineering firm. And then before that, I was in Hong Kong working in finance. And so before I went from Hong Kong to Sweden, I went and got all these beautiful woolen tailored suits made. And I went to this engineering firm in the middle of Sweden, or an hour outside Stockholm. And I turn up thinking I'm dressed the part. Everyone, and this was 20 years ago, everyone was wearing jeans, Birkenstocks or Masseurs and socks. Now, this is 20 years ago, and I was like, whoa. So I had to dump that wardrobe instantly, and I could only afford H&M at that time, but just had to go and start all over again. Then when I moved to Stockholm and I was in an architects firm, about 20 years ago, 18 years ago, the architects at the management level were just wearing jeans and a blazer. And then when I came to Melbourne and we started having architects as clients, I was like, okay, well, you just wear jeans and a blazer. And that was unheard of 16 years ago. No one wore jeans in the workplace. And then now jeans are absolutely acceptable. The pendulum is swinging. I don't think it's going to get to a point where we've got so casual that we're wearing thongs and shorts, weather dependent, of course. But it's not like we're going to keep going. it is going to stop at a certain point and it will swing back. And my store's only been going for 16 years, but I've seen the pendulum swing twice already. So I don't think we have to worry that it's going to keep going, that we're going too casual. It will sort of stop at a certain point and it will become formal again. And it's always coming back to that point. And sorry to repeat myself, but it's so industry specific. But we are seeing, I saw the trends that I saw in Sweden come to Australia about 5 years later, and now what was totally acceptable there is totally acceptable here. And I'm going back now to see, okay, what's the trend so I can get 5 years ahead, but I don't have that answer yet. I'll tell you after June when I go.
I do think it's like it is trend-based as well. And it comes back to that point of acceptability and appropriateness. And who considers what is appropriate, or who kind of designates or says this is what's appropriate in this particular context? And to come back to my political examples, I have a colleague at the University of South Australia who's done a lot of work on Don Dunstan, the Premier, and he wore his very famous short, very, very short pink suit shorts, and made a very strong political statement through wearing those short pink shorts. And he wore safari suits and looked fabulous all of the time. But, you know, that now is not appropriate or acceptable in South Australia, even though Don Dunstan made them semi-acceptable, or tried his very best to do that. And so it does, I think the pendulum swings backwards and forwards. So we'll see.
I always think you can get away with a lot when you look really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He looks very good.
He did. Any more questions?
Hi. I'm curious to hear, I missed the beginning of the conversation, I don't know if you touched upon it, but we're obviously seeing increased consumption happening across, you know, almost all clothing sector, and yet there seems to be an indication that we could probably have a much smaller wardrobe, given that we can wear our day clothes to work and our weekend clothes to work, and everything is much more mixed, and yet that doesn't seem to be reflected in the quantity of clothing that is being sold. So I'm curious what your sense is of why our wardrobes continue to expand, even though actually the diversity of wardrobe seems to be reducing actually across, you know, the spectrum.
Unfortunately, the stats are that our consumption is going to double again by the year 2030. And I think that's largely driven by the decline in quality. So, as well, it's a few factors. The decline in quality is one. So there's a need to kind of keep replacing things over and over again. But then also, the way that fashion businesses make their money is by volume. And so they have an incentive to be marketing to us constantly. And they're very good at it. And they've got kind of direct lines into all of our pockets all the time, and they can follow us around our workplaces all over the internet. You know, everyone here would have paused to look at something on Instagram and then seen it pop up again on, you know, The Guardian, and then again on another website. And that is the reality of what's happened with digital marketing now. And it really is successful. You know, we can see it in our addictive behaviours. Australia, I think we're the second highest consumers of clothes in the world. The stats are terrifying, like 56 new items each a year at an average cost of $6.50. And that's really also reflective of something else that we don't talk about enough here, which is that we don't have proper policing on the standards of what's coming into the country. And there is kind of this unspoken understanding in the experts in the industry that we are a bit of a dumping ground for the world's cheapest fashion. Not to go too deep into this, but I think that really until we kind of re-educate ourselves to understand what good quality is, what good cloth looks like, what a proper, you know, how well a seam should be sewn, and really know how to back ourselves to make investments in pieces that will last a long time, we're not going to see the wardrobes shrink down again. And unfortunately, those skills and that knowledge is being lost. Even within the industry, it's being lost. Like, I was talking with a group of people in the fashion industry about seam allowance in a pair of pants, and they were all like, "What's seam allowance?" And I was like, "Oh God," you know. And then I was on a panel during Melbourne Fashion Week with a designer that I won't name, and she described that kind of detail as a couture detail, which is, yeah, exactly. Sorry, I've taken over this question. Do you have some thoughts as well?
No, thanks, Miriam. It's a really good question. And I think, especially as we see a narrowing in terms of the sorts of clothing that we're wearing, if this is a global trend, global as in, you know, national, of this casualization that what we wear to work we can also wear in all of our other activities, then why are we still buying? And I think Lucianne's answered it really beautifully, that it's, you know, the marketing machine of the fashion industry is so incredibly powerful. So it's a matter of, you know, collective activism against that marketing machine is really the only thing that's going to work, I think.
Yeah, we at Svensk have, from the very day one, made our position to make your wardrobe as small as possible. So the story of fast fashion and cheap fabrics and seam allowances, that's not my business. So our business is absolutely... Our tagline when we first opened was slow fashion for interesting people. We don't use that word anymore because everybody sort of jumped on that slow fashion and it became a little diluted. But I am constantly re-educating my clients. You don't need that. Just get one pair of pants. If it works, then you come back and get the other one. See that you're wearing it. See that you like it. But they've been told, buy multiple, buy this, buy that. And I will say, what is your budget or what do you need? And then don't get that now. That's a piece in my store that I'm going to have next year. I'm going to have it in 5 years' time. That's what we call a carryover piece or a never out of stock piece. So I've actually, I've cut someone's credit card once before and I was like, stop. You're buying too. He was a very good friend. But he came back to me a year later and said, you changed my life. He was so on this a roller coaster or a wheel of just buying, 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 consuming. And a customer will come in and say, I've put on weight. This doesn't fit me anymore. I've lost weight. I'll say, I am going to take you to the tailor. You invested in that suit. It is still good fabric. There is resources there. We've got an amazing tailor down the road. We'll alter this for you. I had a customer call me the other day. He'd spilled oil on his jacket and he was going to buy a new one. And I was like, that is insane. Get some dishwashing liquid, lemon dishwashing liquid. Or you put oil on there, you need a chemical reaction to get it off. It's re-educating people constantly. And he ultimately got that stain out of his jacket and he called me to say, thank you, you saved me. That was... You don't win. Nobody wins if you constantly keep consuming. And I don't want to be a business that thrives on that. We actually spend very, very little of our budget on new season fashion pieces. I could say 80% of my business is these carryover pieces that are consistently in your wardrobe. It's the same black t-shirt, it's the same black pant, because I'm not selling that. Some people come back and want the same black shirt, but we just try and tell people, get these basics because that's what you're going to wear 80% of the time, and then get the event jacket or the event one that you can wear again and again. It's not pink, it's not purple, it hasn't got stripes on it, but it's a really beautiful fit. No one's going to see that you're wearing that same jacket again and again. Or like someone had an event, he's like, I wore that last year. And it's like, put a jewel on it, put some lace decal on it, it will be different again. So and that's how I build my customer loyalty, because I'm constantly teaching them to alter, repair, fix, not to replace constantly. So, yeah, I think there's more businesses like mine. There's just we're small and we can't churn the ship, but we're trying to keep our place. And I think that slowly, slowly, there'll be more businesses like mine over the years. Yeah.
Okay, I think we're out of time.
Yeah, I think so now. So I'd just like to say a big thank you to our speakers, Eric, Harriet, Jane and Lucianne. Also to M Pavilion for hosting us and to the PayPal Melbourne Fashion Festival for including us in the independent program. And to all of you for coming down when it was really hot. It's been a beautiful night. Please stick around for a chat if you feel like it, if you want to ask our speakers any more questions or ask me or my colleagues about Melong Glow or Public Office. Thanks for coming.
You've been listening to an M Pavilion podcast recorded on the lands of the Eastern Kulin Nation. For more, visit our archive at mpavilion.org and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.